Ladies and gentlemen, recording from Los Angeles, California. Welcome to another edition of the one and only podcast known to the world as Sean's Sports Stop, where Sean Teplitsky gives his unique opinion on the biggest news stories in sports.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the one and only Sean Sports Stop podcast. This is episode number 416. As always, coming at you live from the beautiful Los Angeles, California. Thank you guys so much for listening. Once again, episode number 416. What a journey it's been. Coming up on 6 years since I started the podcast. That is something that I can't even, that my mind doesn't quite comprehend. I mean, I can't believe how fast time flies. It is truly remarkable. We got some good stuff to talk about on today's episode. NFL, of course, a little bit of NHL, some college sports, UFC 295. We're going to start with that in a second. But first, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, Crimson IT, as always. Shout out my friends at Crimson IT. If you or someone you know has a small or medium-sized company that needs managed IT services, head over to crimsonit.com. Tell them that you found them from the Sean Sports Talk podcast, from your boy Sean, the one and only Sean Sports Talk podcast, and they'll give you a nice discount. They'll take care of you, no doubt about it. They also do cybersecurity as well. With all that good stuff said, go check out Crimson IT. We're going to start off with a recap of UFC 295. I mean, it's only right. We just had the legendary UFC ring announcer, Bruce Buffer. You know, he was kind enough to do the intro for this podcast. So what better way to recognize him, as if he needs my recognition, than what better way than starting off with UFC 295. Tom Aspinall became the new UFC interim heavyweight champion of the world with a first round knockout win over Sergey Pavlovich in the co-main event of UFC 295 from Madison Square Garden in New York City. This was the co-main event of the evening. The original main event was supposed to be John Jones versus Stipe Miocic for the UFC Heavyweight Championship. No interim status around that. But John Jones got injured, and Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Pavlovich for the interim heavyweight championship took place instead. The interim belt is essentially number one contender status, so Tom Aspinall is the new number one contender for John Jones's belt. In a battle of heavyweight sluggers, it shouldn't have come as a surprise that all it took was one punch for Aspinall to claim the crown. Aspinall fired a stinging right hand that put Pavlovich on skates, then followed up with one more down the pipe to earn the finish. After the fight, Aspinall recognized just how wild it was that he took the fight on less than 3 weeks' notice and is now the interim champion. Saying, quote, "It's been a crazy 2.5 weeks. If you've ever have a chance to do something and you're scared to do it, you should definitely do it because it can pay off." The interim title brings some more legitimacy to a rising star in Tom Aspinall. The 30-year-old has been putting together impressive wins since making his UFC debut in 2020. Coming into this fight, he was 6-1 with all 6 wins coming by way of either knockout or submission. His only loss in the UFC has a major asterisk. I remember watching this fight last year. He technically lost to Curtis Blaydes in 15 seconds, but it was because he tore his knee. So, yes, it's a loss on his record, but is it really a loss? Who knows, they might run him back someday. With the interim belt around his waist, it's safe to say he's moved on from that unfortunate result. Where the division goes from here, though, is going to be interesting for sure. Aspinall started campaigning for a shot at champion John Jones even before he won the fight. Saying, quote, "I'd love to fight John Jones. I've said that all along. It's not disrespect to John Jones. I couldn't respect him more for what he's done in the sport. I'd like to fight John Jones after this for sure." That's where things get tricky. Even though Aspinall is now the interim champion and number one contender, it doesn't mean that he will get the next shot at John Jones. This date, as I said, was originally reserved for a heavyweight showdown between current champion John Jones and former champion and arguably the greatest heavyweight in UFC history, Stipe Miocic. However, Jones was forced to pull out of the fight with a torn pectoral tendon. Aspinall, obviously, as I've been saying, now has the interim title, but Jones had talked to media about potentially retiring after his fight with Miocic. So it's really dicey here now. Mike Grimondi of ESPN reported that the UFC is still planning on rebooking a fight between Stipe and John Jones. There's a good chance that fight winds up being the swan song for both Jones and the 41-year-old Stipe. It would mark the end of an era with two older champions putting on their final show. That would make this fight the dawn of the Aspinall era in the heavyweight division. He is unbelievable. I'm not sure that anybody can beat him right now, to be honest. And yeah, I mean, shout out to Aspinall. I thought personally that Pavlovich would win, and Pavlovich landed a big left hook in the first round. Aspinall took it well. He ate it, landed his own big shot, and that's all he needed to win the fight. He's unbelievably talented. Pavlovich had 6 straight first round knockouts coming into this fight. So these were two top contenders, and Aspinall won on the night. Who knows? Pavlovich could have won on a different night. Now for the main event. Alex Pereira, what a fighter he is. What a revelation he has been. He has claimed another UFC title with a second round TKO win over Jiří Procházka to become the new UFC light heavyweight champion in the main event of UFC 295 from Madison Square Garden in New York City. Pereira took the early lead in the fight with a barrage of leg kicks early in the first round that battered Prochazka's lead leg. It was a round that had a little bit of everything. Jiří then answered with some grappling, but nearly got caught with a standing guillotine. Prochazka was able to have limited success with that approach, but Pereira ultimately worked his way back to the feet by the end of the round. Fortunately for the new champion, the second round started on the feet, where it became clear that he had the advantage. I mean, he's only multiple division kickboxing champion, but who would have thought that he would have the advantage on the feet? With Prochazka coming in to land the right hook, Pereira uncorked a perfectly timed left hand that put Prochazka on the ground and drew the stoppage. The decision to end the fight won't go without some criticism. A lot of people felt that it was a bit of an early stoppage. Famous MMA journalist Ariel Helwani tweeted, quote, "At first glance, that felt like an early stoppage. Upon watching the replay, it feels like an early stoppage. Prochazka was definitely hurt. Just feels like it could have breathed a little more." And I would agree with that. But my personal take on this, because, you know, I'm someone that has had... I've had a friend die, during a boxing fight or because of a boxing fight. So while I do concede that it was a bit of an early stoppage, I personally would much rather the stoppage be a little early than a little too late. And I think most people would agree with me on that one. Jiří Procházka himself poured water on the controversy pretty quickly in his post-fight interview, keeping it classy in the wake of a tough loss, saying, quote, "In the end, I think he was right. I was out." Pereira is now the champion of a division that he has only fought in twice. The former middleweight champion beat Jan Blachowicz by split decision in his 205-pound debut at UFC 291, just a few months later, and he's the champion. It's just the latest wild development in a division that has been characterized by chaos since John Jones, the aforementioned John Jones, vacated the title in 2020. The UFC has crowned 4 champions since then, and Blachowicz is the only one to defend the belt. That's crazy. The one known for his Polish power beat Dominic Reyes for the belt and defended it against Israel Adesanya, or Adesanya, as Ariel Helwani likes to say, in his light heavyweight debut and what is likely his only light heavyweight fight. Then Prochazka claimed the belt from Blachowicz and the madness started. Prochazka vacated the light heavyweight championship after he won it because he suffered a serious shoulder injury while preparing for a rematch with Glover Teixeira. With Prochazka out of commission, the UFC had a title fight between Magomed Ankalaev and Jan Blachowicz, but they fought to a draw and no champion was crowned. Jamahal Hill then beat Glover Teixeira to claim the crown, but he was forced to drop the belt because of a ruptured Achilles tendon. Now it's Pereira's turn to try and become the face of the division. Of course, there are already challengers who are making their case to fight for the belt, and that includes Jamahal Hill, who is trying to come back from his own serious injury, saying, quote, "My time is coming back. I'll be back. It's only a bump in the road. Whenever I come back, it's right back like I never left." With Hill vacating the belt in July, it might be a little aggressive for him to be Pereira's title defense, but it might be the most anticipated matchup available right now. I don't know. I personally think Pereira should fight Jan Blachowicz again. I mean, they had a very, very close fight. It was a split decision win for Pereira. I don't remember the fight that well, but I think they should run that. I mean, Jamahal Hill, he was the champion and he had to vacate, so I guess he would get first priority. But, you know, I trust Pereira. He's he always finds himself in big fights. He is arguably the face of the UFC right now. I mean, this guy made his UFC debut in November of 2021, knocked out Israel Adesanya for a second time a year ago, almost a year to the day that he knocked out Jiří Procházka, knocked out Adesanya to become the new UFC middleweight champion. Then Adesanya knocked him out to reclaim his championship. Pereira then decided to move up in weight, a very smart decision. He was killing himself to make 185 pounds, the UFC middleweight limit. And now, in his second fight at light heavyweight, he's the new light heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, he is now a two-division UFC champion. It's unbelievable, really. He's only had 11 professional MMA fights, so that is just unbelievable. He has beaten four current or former UFC champions in his UFC career. I mean, it's just unbelievable what he's done in such a short period of time and in such a little number of fights. It's really unprecedented, and I'm looking forward to see him keep fighting. Now we switch gears to the NFL. There's a possibility that 2023 could be the final season of Bill Belichick's storied career as head coach of the New England Patriots, according to The Athletic. Man, I feel pretty good seeing this, because I don't know if you guys remember, but a few episodes ago with Shaggy, the Patriots and Bill Belichick came up, and I told him, I was like, what is Bill Belichick still doing? I mean, he's pretty old at this point. He's done everything there is to do. He's obviously a Hall of Famer, so many Super Bowl championships. I mean, what is he doing with this mediocre and borderline bad Patriots team with Mac Jones that's seemingly going in no direction and seemingly has no future? But The Athletic said, quote, in talking to those who have spent time around the Patriots organization and understand the dynamics between team owner Robert Kraft and Belichick, I don't expect anything to be determined with so much season remaining. But if people I talked to had to bet, their money is on a mutual parting of the ways at the end of the season. This would be a surprising development, as Belichick and the Patriots, quote, quietly agreed to a lucrative multi-year new contract prior to this season. The exact terms of the deal were never released. Belichick is one of the most decorated head coaches in NFL history, winning 6 Super Bowls throughout his career in New England. He's been named Coach of the Year 3 times in that span. However, the team has been much less successful as of late, and that coincides with Tom Brady's departure. Is that a direct causation? I'm not sure. I mean, I was taught in my statistics class to never confuse or never equate correlation and causation as the same thing. But yeah, the Patriots have missed the playoffs in 2 of the past 3 seasons, with their only postseason appearance resulting in a 30-point loss in the wildcard round following the 2021 season. In 2023, the Patriots currently sit in last place in the AFC East with a 2-8 record. If the Patriots are unable to climb out of the division's basement, it would be the organization's first last place finish in over 20 years. Belichick's teams have been known for having elite defenses, although that has disappeared this season as well. New England is allowing 25.3 points a game, which is the 7th worst in the NFL. While his departure from the franchise is far from imminent, a poor finish to the season could result in the mutual exit of the longest tenured head coach in the league. Now, I'm not sure if the Patriots want to move on from Bill Belichick, if they feel like they should move on from Bill Belichick, or if I feel like that they should. I'm not really sure. I think they should, you know, stick with him if he wants to stay. But from Bill Belichick's point of view, as I said on the episode with Shaggy, I mean, I don't really see why he would keep coaching unless he truly, truly loves it that much to do it. You know, I don't know how old he is. He's probably pushing 80 at this point. And to do it at that age with a team that's not very good at all, I mean, I can't say I really understand it, but, you know, if whatever floats his boat, Belichick is certainly an interesting character. There's no doubt about that. And with that, let's transition to the NBA. Philadelphia 76ers forward Kelly Oubre Jr. was hospitalized and later released after being struck by a vehicle in Philadelphia on Saturday night, according to Woj of ESPN. The team announced that Oubre suffered a fractured rib and the player will be reevaluated in 1 week, according to ESPN. The Athletic previously reported that Oubre had, quote, an assortment of bruises and cuts to his body in addition to the rib injury. Oubre will work closely with the 76ers medical staff on treatment and care for his injuries, per Woj. He's expected to miss a significant amount of time because of his injuries, which are not considered to be season-ending. So, Not good news for Philly, but at least the silver lining is that the injuries are not considered season-ending. The 27-year-old was walking near his residence when hit by the vehicle, and local authorities are investigating the incident. The Sixers later confirmed the news with a statement on social media. Oubre signed a one-year deal with the Sixers during the offseason and became an important member of the team's rotation following the departure of James Harden to the Los Angeles Clippers. Through 8 games since then, Oubre has been averaging over 16 points, over 5 rebounds, and 1.5 steals while shooting 50% from the floor and 38% from 3. So very, very solid numbers for a, not a role player, but, you know, a starter on the Sixers. In part, thanks to Oubre, the Sixers are first in the Eastern Conference with a 7-1 record, topping the new-look Boston Celtics and Milwaukee Bucks for bragging rights thus far. Now that Oubre is expected to miss significant time, Furkan Korkmaz, Marcus Morris Sr., and KJ Martin figure to see more playing time. Prior to joining the Sixers, Oubre spent 2 seasons with the Charlotte Hornets. He put together a career year in 2022-23, averaging over 20 points, over 5 rebounds, over 1 assist, and 1.5 steals in 48 games, while shooting 43% from the floor and 32% from 3. So his shooting percentages are much better. He's shooting 7% better from the floor overall and 6% better from the three-point line. That is very impressive. Albeit he might be shooting less. He might have been shooting less with the Sixers. Having less of a role, being on a team with Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey. Whereas on the Hornets, I'm sure a lot of the times he was the number one option, especially with LaMelo Ball's injuries. Oubre was a first-round pick drafted by the Atlanta Hawks in 2015, though he was traded to the Washington Wizards and made his NBA debut with the Wizards during the 2015-16 season. The Kansas product has also played for the Phoenix Suns and Golden State Warriors over his 9-year career. That's pretty crazy. I, for some reason, felt like Oubre was on way more teams than just the Wizards, Suns, Warriors, Hornets, and Sixers. I mean, that's not a small number of teams either. That's not a small number of teams either. Speaking of small, this guy's contract was far from small. Jimbo Fisher, I mean, what a name. Jimbo Fisher's time as the head coach of the Texas A&M football team is over. Texas A&M Director of Athletics Ross Bjork announced on Sunday saying, quote, "After very careful analysis of all the components related to Texas A&M football, I recommended to President Welsh and then Chancellor Sharp that a change in the leadership of the program was necessary in order for Aggie football to reach our full potential, and they accepted my decision. We appreciate Coach Fisher's time here at Texas A&M, and we wish him the best in his future endeavors. While the Aggies did beat Mississippi State on Saturday, they are only 6-4 overall and 4-3 in the SEC this season. Per ESPN, associate head coach Elijah Robinson will take over in an interim role. This will be a costly move for Texas A&M. He's made $45 million there thus far, and he will receive a $77 million buyout with no offset against future coaching earnings." Wow. Jimbo Fisher is a future Business of Sports Hall of Famer, no doubt about that. As Yahoo Sports reported, Fisher's contract that was extended ahead of the 2021 season, quote, "is believed to be fully guaranteed and was at the time worth about $95 million. As a result, he's expected to receive, quote, "the largest single buyout paid to a football coach that will nearly eclipse the entire amount spent to buy out coaches last year, which hovered around $90 million. It was also reported that the plan is to fully honor the contract. I mean, what else could they do? It was also pointed out that the $76 million owed to Fisher, quote, "is more than double the known buyout paid to a fired college head coach. Despite the financial implications of such a move, it was reported that, quote, "intense pressure has been building to make such a decision among the school's fan base, donors, and administrators." With that as the backdrop, the Texas A&M University Board of Regents met for more than 4 hours on Thursday to lay the groundwork for such a move. I mean, yeah, it's not exactly easy to... I assume it's not exactly easy for a university to pay someone $90 million to not coach their football team. Fisher came to the Aggies before the 2018 season after 8 seasons as the head coach of the Florida State Seminoles. He won a BCS National Championship and 2 Orange Bowls with the Seminoles. He also reached the college football playoff in 2014 and went 83-23 during his tenure with the ACC program. That success seemed to set the stage for an ideal partnership between an accomplished coach and an SEC team with plenty of resources. It started that way, for sure. With the Aggies showing notable improvement from Fisher's first 2 years into his third, that third season was the shortened 2021, which saw them go 9-1, win the Orange Bowl, and just barely miss the illustrious college football playoff. It turned out to be the highlight of his tenure with the Aggies, as they went only 4-4 in the SEC in 2021 and an ugly 2-6 in 2022. They're 5-10 in their last 15 games against Power 5 opponents, and they will settle for a lower-level bowl this year following a 6-4 start, regardless of how they do in the final two games against Abilene Christian and LSU. The Aggies never made the SEC championship game during Fisher's six seasons and are well behind the likes of, obviously, the Georgia Bulldogs and Alabama Crimson Tide in the conference. The school's leadership decided it was time to make a change and reportedly did so on Sunday. I mean, it's the right decision, but as stated, it's a very costly one. Speaking of head coaches getting fired, the Edmonton Oilers. It's not too often that we talk about the NHL on this show, but the Edmonton Oilers, how the mighty have fallen. They have fired head coach Jay Woodcroft after the team's disappointing 3-9-1 start to the 2023-24 season, the team announced on Sunday. The 47-year-old took over during the 2021-22 season after Dave Tippett was fired, leading the Oilers to a 79-41-13 record in parts of three seasons and two playoff berths. The Oilers will replace Woodcroft with Chris Knobloch, currently the head coach of the AHL's Hartford Wolfpack. He previously coached superstar Connor McDavid with the OHL's Erie Otters. The Oilers lost in the Western Conference Finals in his first season and the second round of the playoffs last year, beating my Los Angeles Kings in the first round both times, so I fucking hate the Oilers. But the team's brutal start to the season did him in. Quote, "No one's happy with where we're at," he told reporters on Thursday when asked if he was concerned about his job security. "We all own it. We can be better, and that's where my focus is." The Oilers won 4-1 over the Seattle Kraken on Saturday night, offering what felt like a possible reprieve for Woodcroft. It wasn't to be, and it's fair to question if the head coach was really the biggest issue for the Oilers, as Edmonton's goalies have a 3.92 goals against average, which is the third worst in the NHL, and a league worst 866 save percentage. Superstar Leon Draisaitl only has one goal in his last 10 games. That is insane. Connor McDavid, who has exceeded 100 points six times in his career, put up 153 points last year. That is alien. 153 points. Points in the NHL or in hockey are defined as goals or assists. And he's still, no doubt, the NHL's best player. He has only 10 points in 11 games. That is good. That is great for most players. But for Connor McDavid, for the heir to Wayne Gretzky's throne, that is below a point per game. That is crazy how so far the mighty have fallen in Edmonton. I mean, you simultaneously have Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl being complete ghosts, as well as their goaltending being the worst in the NHL. I mean, take a fucking struggle, Oilers. Holy shit. I mean, like, I hate the Oilers, but I almost feel bad for them. This is crazy. McDavid said, quote, but also McDavid has dealt with an upper body injury earlier in the year that's almost certainly playing a part in his struggles. And he said, quote, "Everybody goes through struggles. We're no different. We're human. It's been a really long time since we've gone through something like this. It's not fun. It's not fun to go through it as a group. This time around, however, it cost Woodcroft his job. Knobloch will be tasked with helping these Oilers regain their mojo and make a push for the postseason." Quote, "I don't think anyone obviously feels very good about their game or is feeling very confident out there," McDavid added on Friday. "How do you instill that? If I had that answer, I probably wouldn't be playing hockey. I'd be a billionaire somewhere." That's funny. "It's not easy. Confidence is a tricky thing." That is 100% right, Mr. McDavid. And yeah, it brings me immense joy to see the Oilers struggle as much as they have been struggling. In case you love listening about coaches getting fired, we got another one for you. The Penn State Nittany Lions managed only 238 yards of offense, including only 74 yards through the air and 15 points against Michigan on Saturday. It was another disappointing performance against a top conference rival after a 20-12 loss to Ohio State in October. Those performances were reportedly the final straw for offensive coordinator Mike Yurkic. And according to On3.com, Penn State fired him on Sunday. Yurkic is 48 years old. He served as Penn State's play caller and quarterback's coach dating back to the 2021 season. Head coach James Franklin was critical of the game plan following the loss to Michigan, perhaps foreshadowing Sunday's move, saying, quote, We've got to do a better job of calling a game to allow our quarterback to get into rhythm. That is critical. We've got to find easy completions for a quarterback to get into rhythm. That's what everybody does. We've got to do a good job of that. And then on top of that, although there weren't sacks, there were too many pressures, and there were too many times where we were not creating separation. The Nittany Lions have churned through offensive coordinators during Franklin's 10 years on the job. It's going to be the sixth one after... The next one will be the sixth one under James Franklin. The question now, however, is when the spotlight will fall on Franklin himself. He is 4-16 against Michigan and Ohio State during his time in Happy Valley, and his reputation as a coach incapable of winning the biggest games and as an excellent recruiter who struggles with the X's and O's aspect of the job felt solidified after Sunday's performance against a Michigan program without the blacklisted, for now, Jim Harbaugh. So things are not good in the city of brotherly love right now. Quote, we've lost to the number one and the number three team in the country. That's not good enough. We have to find ways to win those games. Penn State has four seasons with double-digit wins under Franklin and appears headed for a fifth. It won't be enough to get them into this year's college football playoff. However, obviously, they've lost to Ohio State and Michigan, who will be in there. Granted, 10-win seasons may become a bit more palatable for Penn State in the future when the playoff format expands from four teams to 12, and I think that is way overdue, personally. The counterpoint, of course, is that the addition of USC, Oregon, Washington, and UCLA is about to make the Big Ten an even tougher conference to play in. So Franklin needs to get the offensive coordinator appointment right this time, because at some point, the spotlight is going to fall on him. Let's transition to some more NFL. Aaron Rodgers currently has his sights set on a return before the end of the 2023 season. He told Melissa Stark of NBC that he's currently targeting a, quote, mid-December return to the New York Jets. That would be unbelievable. Rodgers tore his ACL in the first quarter of the first game of the season for the Jets. While New York's offense has struggled without the four-time MVP under center, the team currently sits at 4-4 through eight games. That puts them only half a game back of the final AFC playoff spot heading into Sunday night, so they're not out of it yet. While Rodgers' health is paramount, it seems as though his return will likely hinge on the Jets' postseason chances. After all, it doesn't make sense to speed up his rehab if New York is eliminated from the playoffs by the time he's ready to come back. He said as much when speaking about his recovery on his good friend's Pat McAfee show, saying, quote, it's going to be a process of small gains every single day. Hopefully there's a chance to have that conversation, but obviously we got to be in the mix. But more than that, I have to be able to be healthy to protect myself and have strength in all of the throwing positions. Although the 39-year-old is confident in his ability to return, it's fair to wonder if he'll truly be healthy enough to play before the end of this season. I'm not sure he should risk it. Everyone isn't sold on the idea of Rodgers coming back so soon per Pro Football Talk, which says, quote, a source positioned to make informed estimates on the situation believes the most likely return for Rodgers at this point will be the start of OTAs in 2024. And I think that is the right choice, 100%, unless the Jets truly have a chance of making the playoffs this season, which I don't think they do. In the meantime, Zach Wilson will continue to start at quarterback. The former number two overall pick in the 2021 draft has dealt with his fair share of struggles under center himself. Wilson has completed only 59% of his passes for 1,460 yards in seven starts, tossing four touchdowns to go along with an equal four interceptions. Speaking of the Jets, as I said, I don't think Rodgers should rush back this season. I really don't think he should. Speaking of the Jets, at the trade deadline, the New York Jets reportedly made an effort to bolster their offense and make their injured veteran quarterback very happy by taking a run at trading for veteran wide receiver Davante Adams. The Jets were rebuffed by the Las Vegas Raiders, but despite downing the Jets on Sunday night, the reality is the Raiders are heading for a rebuild in 2024. Given the state of the franchise, the team may be more amenable to moving the veteran in an effort to procure additional draft capital in the offseason. That Adams would make the Jets better isn't in question, but whether that one player and a healthy Rodgers could truly make the Jets a Super Bowl contender in a loaded AFC is another question altogether. I think they would be Super Bowl contenders with Aaron Rodgers and Davante Adams because the Jets' defense is unbelievably good. While watching the Jets lose 16-12 to the Raiders on Sunday night, a few things were plainly evident. The first is that the Jets have an excellent defense at every single level, at all three levels, Gang Green has a deep and talented defensive line, one of the best off-ball linebacker duos in the NFL in C.J. Mosley and Quincy Williams, and of course, an excellent secondary led by cornerbacks Sauce Gardner and D.J. Reed. The second also is that Greg Zuerlein, Greg the Leg, Rams legend, love this guy, is a great kicker. We know this because he kicks a bunch of field goals every game and he makes all of them. But that's rather the problem. The Jets lead the league in percentage of their points that come from via field goals. They have gone nearly 40 drives without finding the end zone. The offense just cannot score touchdowns right now. Now, it's easy to point to the quarterback position as the reason for those struggles and just blame Zach Wilson. There's a reason why the Jets traded for Rodgers in the offseason, only to, as I just talked about, see the four-time MVP brutally tear his Achilles tendon on the team's first series of the season. I mean, the Jets are fucking cursed at this point. To say that the drop-off from Rodgers to Zach Wilson is precipitous is an understatement. But the New York offense has other problems. One of the main ones is a lack of talent behind Garrett Wilson at wide receiver. Entering Sunday's game, Garrett Wilson had 549 receiving yards. No other player on the Jets had 300. Of Zach Wilson's 37 pass attempts Sunday night, 14 were directed at Garrett Wilson, twice as many as any other pass catcher. That Devontae Adams would add a new dimension to the Jets' offense is obvious. His numbers may be down by his standards this year, but playing with Rodgers in Green Bay, Adams posted 100-plus catches, 1,300-plus yards, and double-digit touchdowns in three separate seasons. Now, there are a few potential roadblocks to an Adams trade. The first is that now-fired head coach Josh McDaniels and general manager Dave Ziegler already nixed the idea once. Once a new permanent head coach and GM are named in Las Vegas, they may be every bit as reluctant to deal arguably the team's most dangerous offensive weapon. Also, while Adams wasn't the happiest camper in Vegas earlier in the season, as ESPN wrote, the installation of interim head coach Antonio Pierce appears to have reinvigorated him, which is awesome. Quote, AP is not going to get in there and say, run this play for Tay, Adams said. He don't know any of our plays. He's over there coaching linebackers and dealing with the defense. So I think it's more about just having him shape our minds, getting us ready to go out there. I mean, I'm already ready to run through a wall for that man, so it's a good feeling. But for argument's sake, let's say the new GM in Vegas sees the writing on the wall that this isn't a team that's one player away from challenging the Chiefs in the AFC West. Let's say the Jets are willing to part with enough compensation, including their first-round pick in 2024 most likely, to convince that new GM to make the deal. And let's say that Adams is amenable to changing teams again next year. After all, he and Rodgers did look pretty buddy-buddy on Sunday night. Pairing Adams and Wilson would give the Jets arguably the best wideout duo in the league. I mean, Garrett Wilson is a Devontae Adams Jr., essentially. Adams is down 2023, again, for his standards, has a lot less to do with his age than the sad state of the quarterback position in Las Vegas. Add in running back, I mean, you got Aiden O'Connell throwing in passes, and previously, who's doing a great job, by the way, not hating on him. And previously, you had Jimmy Garoppolo. You add in running back Breece Hall, and you have a scary collection of skill position talent on offense. What you don't have is a guaranteed trip to New Orleans. For starters, the health of Rodgers remains a huge question mark. There has been chatter that Rodgers could return this season, as I just talked about, but with every Jets loss, that will become less and less likely. When Rodgers does return, he will be a 39-year-old quarterback coming off a serious injury whose last full season was not very great. Is he light years better than Wilson, Zach Wilson? Of course, but it was already no sure bet that Rodgers and the Jets were going to get was the one who won four MVP awards. But we'll just have to see how this all plays out. We'll just have to see. I mean, my prediction is that my prediction is essentially Occam's razor, and Occam's razor is defined as the simplest explanation is the correct one most of the time. And so my prediction on this is Occam's razor. The Jets missed the playoffs and Rodgers doesn't play again this season. With that, let's switch gears back to some NBA. Let's talk about some fun NBA trades to close out this episode of the Sean Sports Thought Podcast. Less than a month into the 2023-24 season, it already feels like a few teams and players could use a shakeup. Here, I'll offer some options that are a little outside the box. Instead of rehashing the rumors and ideas that we've all been hearing for weeks, and in some cases months, like Zach LaVine to the Sixers, Pascal Siakam to the Hawks, we'll get a little wilder. The players I'm about to mention have certainly been the rumor mill at various times over the offseason and early parts of this season, but we're hypothetically sending them to destinations that haven't been discussed, or at least not extensively, starting off with Kyle Kuzma to the 76ers. So this trade is Kyle Kuzma for Marcus Morris Sr., Furkan Korkmaz, Dan Wellhouse Jr., and a 2026 first-round pick. Hear me out on this one. Even without James Harden logging a single second for the team prior to this trade, The Sixers are putting up plenty of points right now, but Harden had an undeniably positive impact on last season's attack. And as I mentioned, as I talked about earlier on this episode, Kelly Oubre Jr. got hit by a car and suffered broken ribs and other injuries. Philadelphia might need a punch on offense, and the Washington Wizards already look like a borderline lock to be in the lottery this coming summer. That means their veteran score... Wow, that is pretty crazy that I'm referring to Kyle Kuzma as a veteran. Yet another example of how fucking fast time flies. So yeah, that leaves 28-year-old veteran Kyle Kuzma. The Sixers could use some portion of the return they got for Harden to land him. Kuzma has been far from the most efficient scorer over the past several years, but this deal would probably make him a reserve in Philadelphia. His ability to score in bunches might be even more effective against reserves. For the Wizards, this deal gives them three expiring contracts, which would open up some flexibility this offseason. A first-rounder for Kuzma is good value for a team in the asset and talent accumulation phase of their rebuild. Next up, we got DeMar DeRozan to the Lakers. I mean, I had to do it. So DeMar DeRozan to the Lakers in exchange for D'Angelo Russell, Gabe Vincent, and a 2030 first-round pick. Los Angeles Lakers fans would surely quibble over giving up a first-round pick for DeMar DeRozan. He's 34 years old, has long played an inefficient brand of basketball, and has negatively impacted his team's plus-minus in 13 of his 15 seasons. But DeRozan's expiring contract offers the team a little more flexibility than those of D'Angelo Russell, who has a player option for 2024-25, and Gabe Vincent, who's under contract through 2025-26. Neither guard is really lighting things up right now either. Unloading them for a wing could simplify some rotation decisions for Coach Darvin Ham. In the aftermath of a deal like this, the Lakers would almost be forced to play Austin Reeves or LeBron James at point guard, which would allow them to fill out the rest of the roster with size and defensive switchability. For the Chicago Bulls, it's long past time to start a full-fledged rebuild. For the past two-plus seasons they've been together, the team had been just playing bad when all three of DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, and Nikola Vucevic are on the floor. The front office should realize this, and they should be looking to get whatever assets they can for any of those three and look to start over. And we're going to keep it going with the Bulls. Zach LaVine to the New York Knicks. It's a blockbuster in exchange for RJ Barrett, Evan Fournier, a 2024 first-round pick, and a 2027 first-round pick. With a treasure trove of future assets and multiple movable contracts, the New York Knicks have looked like one of the league's top star hunters for years. They were in the mix for Donovan Mitchell during the 2022 offseason. When Joel Embiid trade rumors crept up this past summer, the Knicks were involved in that as well. But either one of those acquisitions would have cost New York most of their picks and prospects. Zach LaVine, on the other hand, probably would not. It's already clear that Evan Fournier is not a part of the Knicks' plans. He wasn't in the rotation last season and has yet to play a single minute this season. I frankly forgot that he was on the Knicks. I really did. While there might still be some untapped potential for RJ Barrett, it's starting to feel that him developing into the player that Zach LaVine is now would be a long shot at best, and Barrett isn't good at long shots. I had to. Over the course of his career, Barrett has been one of the game's least efficient scorers, and the Knicks have been better when he's off the floor. Replacing him with LaVine's explosive scoring ability and outside shooting would open up the floor for the slashing of Jalen Brunson and Julius Randle, and increase the team's chances of winning a second-round series. For Chicago, this obviously fits with the rebuilding strategy laid out with the previous player in DeMar DeRozan. The Bulls, in my opinion, need an entirely new start, and getting multiple picks for DeRozan and LaVine would provide a good foundation for the rebuild. Next up, Malcolm Brogdon to the Cleveland Cavaliers. The trade would be Malcolm Brogdon to the Cavs for Caris LeVert, Isaac Okoro, a 2025 second-round pick via the Bucks, and a 2026 second-round pick. A Malcolm Brogdon trade feels about as inevitable for the Portland Trailblazers as the Jrue Holiday deal that landed Brogdon there in the first place. He doesn't fit the timeline much better than Holiday, and his presence on the roster, though probably good for young players as an example of professionalism and leadership, is only hurting the team's 2024 lottery odds. The sooner Portland trades the 2022-23 Sixth Man of the Year, the likelier it'll be to secure a top-5 pick in next summer's draft. Even if the Blazers can't get a first-rounder for him, there's a long-term value in simply removing him from the rotation, something that's more justifiable from a front office perspective than it is for head coach Chauncey Billups. The Cleveland Cavaliers are a team that could use more depth, shooting, and table setting in the backcourt. The Cavs are near the bottom third of the league in offense thanks in part to an injury to Darius Garland, Without Ricky Rubio, who decided to sit the season to deal with his mental health, absences from him or Donovan Mitchell are going to be real problems. Having Brogdon would make them make those problems much more survivable. He's more of a distributor and a more reliable outside shooter than Caris LeVert. And while the loss of Isaac Okoro changes the team's long-term prospects a bit, the offseason additions of Max Strus and Georges Niang would help make up for his loss on the wing in the short term. In certain situations, Cleveland might even be able to play all of Garland, Mitchell, and Brogdon together. And lastly, we got Kelly Olynyk to the Thunder in exchange for Alexei Pokushevsky and Ousmane Dieng. Chet Holmgren has clearly filled in some gaps in the Oklahoma City Thunder's rotation, but the team could still use some more size. Holmgren isn't necessarily built to bang inside with Western Conference bruisers like Nikola Jokic, Alperen Sengun, Domantas Sabonis, and Jonas Valanciunas. Man, all those guys are European. Jokic from Serbia, Sengun from Turkey, I believe. Sabonis from Lithuania, and Valanciunas from Lithuania as well. And he has the perimeter skills to play some four. Playing him alongside a more traditionally sized big like Kelly Olynyk would make the Thunder more stout without really sacrificing versatility. Since the start of last season, Olynyk has hit 39.5% of threes and averaged 3.7 assists. His shooting and playmaking in the same lineups with Chet Holmgren, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, Jalen Williams, and Josh Giddey would make the already scary Thunder borderline terrifying. For the Utah Jazz, though, Olynyk fits the team's rebuilding timeline about as well as Brogdon fits Portland's. In other words, he doesn't fit it at all. The Jazz should be angling for picks or young talent to put around Lauri Markkanen, Walker Kessler, and rookie Keyonte George. This deal gives them a 21-year-old Alexei Pokushevsky and a 20-year-old Ousmane Dieng, both of whom have some untapped potential. So with that said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys so much for listening to this episode of the Sean Sports Thought Podcast. This was episode number 416. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.